You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
When Amaziah, priest of the shrine of Bethel, confronts the prophet Amos for conspiring against King Jeroboam, Amos replies with a very specific denial: "I am no prophet nor a prophet's son." For that matter, it's hard to run for president of the United States without insisting early and often that I'm not a politician. What about philosophers? What happens when you ask a philosopher whether or not she's a professional philosopher? We might find that out today as we talk with Rebecca Spera and David P. Pena Guzman about their recent book, Professional Philosophy and Its Myths, from Lexington Books. And even if we don't, I imagine we'll find ourselves posing questions about the field that we call academic philosophy that are worth posing. Rebecca and David, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you for having us.
We appreciate the opportunity.
Your book's title raises a question before we even get started, and I'm going to go ahead and pose that question. The noun myth has a well-documented etymology and also has an expansive range of uses. People write about the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, the myth of American exceptionalism, the myth of primitive communism, and all sorts of myths. So, Rebecca, are the myths we're digging into in our conversation today gods and heroes? Are they two simple stories about complex realities? Or are they some other kind of myth?
Oh, thank you for your question. So obviously in colloquial everyday terms, people often talk about myth in contradistinction to reality. That is specifically not the sense in which we mean the term myths or mythology. We take the term myth to be fairly broad, in the sense of a myth is something that is an implicit image or narrative that gives shape and meaning to particular activities. And obviously we're talking specifically about the myths perpetuated by or implicit within the field of academic philosophy. But we take myth in this broader sense, not in the sense of something that is not true, but in the sense of it's what you picture, right, when you think about a philosophy that has a mythic character. And we outline a number of different myths that we consider to be constitutive of academic philosophers as such, or philosophy as it's understood and practiced today. So our sense of myth here, you know, has stuff in common with American exceptionalism and with maybe even Orpheus and Eurydice, but we really are using a very broad definition of myth. I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that, David?
No, I think that that's right, that we're thinking about myth as something that illuminates aspects of experience and that can guide the thinking of the people toward whom it's directed. And so it is both limiting, but it is also world disclosing in various ways. And the unique thing about our approach is that we're thinking about myths that occur in an occupational setting, literally in an institution where there are workers and bosses and salaries and professions involved. So it's myth meets the professional world, where that profession is academic philosophy.
Very good. Well, David, let's keep running with that, because one of the things that I especially liked about this book's introduction is that you hold that human communities never go without myths, that when a group dispels one myth, they don't simply live without myths, but that another myth rises to take its place. So be an anthropologist for me for a moment, David. What about human beings and human communities disposes towards myths?
So we can play the role of anthropologists, although I want to say we are not, in fact, anthropologists. And I think that's important because it highlights an absence in our book. And that absence is that we don't really talk about what is it about the human mind or human social life that inclines us to myth making. Of course, we could think about various theories for that. There are anthropological theories, there are sociological theories, there are indeed philosophical theories. I'm here thinking about Ernst Cassirer and his philosophical anthropology and his claim that, for example, myth is one of the symbolic functions that humans rely on to make sense of the world. And for Cassirer, of course, the myths that we create through this myth-making function have a number of applications. You can apply them to metaphysical questions, you know, the things that we don't really understand with science. Bam, you introduce a myth. The things that we don't understand about the cosmos. Well, you create a myth to make them hold together in a way that the mind will grasp it. What's important about Cassirer, and I'll connect this to our own thinking about myths in just one second, is that Cassirer also understood that aside from having a metaphysical application and a cosmological application, human myths also have a sociological one in the sense that they hold communities together, and a pedagogical one. Sometimes we use myths to teach things, to convey lessons and values from a teacher to a student. If I were to use these concepts to illuminate our own book, I would say that we're thinking about myth in that sociological and pedagogical sense. We're thinking about myths that hold the community of academic philosophers together and give us a sense of identity that then guides our behavior. At the same time, because it holds us together, we use these myths in our pedagogy, right? We teach them as what it means to become a philosopher. And so for our listeners who maybe haven't read the book, I just want to flag that although myth is titular and it is central in our book, we don't go so far as to offer on anthropological grounds an account of why it is that humans might be the myth-making animal, or what is it about our relationship to the world that maybe necessitates that myth-making function.
Right. Rebecca, if I could follow up on that, I mean, one of the common threads that I heard, you know, in some of the accounts that David laid down there is that these myths bring a community together. And I know that philosophers are suspicious of etymologies, but I'm reminded of one of the popular etymologies of the word religion, the Latin religare, to bind together. You know, I mean, when it comes to that, I mean, you know, again, you know, I'm asking you all to go, you know, places that your book doesn't necessarily go. But, you know, I mean, what kinds of things do these myths have in common with what we think of as religions, and what kinds of things distinguish them?
I mean, I guess the thing in common could just be exactly as you said, which is, you know, if we understand like religious practice to be a community building or community establishing function, or however one wants to play out the causality there, in that sense, it's somewhat similar. You know, if we understand, you know, mythology as being a way of seeing the world or a way of making sense of the world, there perhaps could even be like a certain continuity with religious belief in its like epistemological or world illuminating function. But I'm not much of a philosopher of religion, if I'm honest. So that's about as far as I'd be willing to venture. But I think there could be interesting points of both convergence and divergence. I think maybe one difference is that philosophy, you know, religion has its, you know, overt doxa and its doctrine and the sort of things that are believed about the world and are known to its practitioners. Whereas the way myth functions, we argue in the book, in philosophy, is we don't necessarily avow these myths. These are not necessarily an orthodoxy in the sense that you could get, you know, you survey a bunch of philosophers and they're going to sign under this myth.
Right. So, no one's going to start out by saying credo.
Yeah, precisely. So that might be a crucial difference. And I think part of what we're trying to outline in this book is we must become aware of these as myths, not in the sense of going through it in the process of demythologizing so we can get down to like a layer of reality, so much as being aware of the role that it plays in our professional lives as philosophers. And as we argue in the book, some of the effects here are pernicious and in fact perpetuates things about the field that many of us want to change. But David, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
I mean, in all areas of social life, in all, let's say, social forms, whether that's religion or philosophy or sports or government, there are operating myths. The thing that I think sets philosophy apart is precisely our denial of our myth-making function, because we talk about in the book how, especially if you look at ancient Greek thought, which many people consider the origin of Western philosophy, there is this notion that philosophy is the antithesis of myth, that, you know, you have myth makers, and then you have philosophers. And the difference is that philosophers are guided by logos, by speech, discourse, or rationality, and that forecloses the possibility of philosophy having myths. In fact, by definition, on this view, philosophy is the absence of myth. It's the overcoming of myth. And what we want to do in this book is sort of take a little stick and hit philosophers over the head in connection to the self-conception by saying we envision ourselves, we fashion ourselves as the unmythic or anti-mythic thinkers, but in fact, that idea is the ultimate philosophical myth, right? That is part of our mythology. Our mythology is that we are the thinkers who have left behind the fetters of fantasy and illusion in order to have some kind of unobstructed access to the real. And there is nothing more mythic than that.
Oh, yeah.
Right. It's interesting. I think we've got Hegel at least in part to thank for that, because I mean, I remember in Phenomenology, he writes about, you know, philosophy as overcoming picture thinking. And I don't have any German at all, but it seems like picture and mythos are at least a little bit related. But I want to go to another Latin word. And Rebecca, one of the words that I am familiar with from theology context, to be sure, but not nearly as much from sociology or, you know, the project of this book more broadly, is imago. So first of all, I mean, what's the history of the use of imago that appears in this book? And second, what parts of the project, you know, when you are examining sort of the, well, once you explain what imago is, the imago of the philosopher, what parts of that, you know, are continuous with work that other people have done with the sociology of the university, and what parts are kind of new with your research?
Okay, what a wonderful set of questions. I'll begin, of course, with the imago. So the term imago in the book serves as a shorthand for the figure of the typical successful philosopher in his, and we do use the word his advisedly, specific sociological facticity. These are the philosophers who end up generally being in positions of success and thus, inevitably perhaps, end up being aspirational figures, i.e. philosophers who are undergoing philosophical training see the image of this person, and as we argue in the book, statistically speaking, he is likely to be a white man. You know, we can just even think about, just picture a philosophy professor and you're picturing a man with a beard and maybe some elbow patches and a pipe. We use the term imago because we're borrowing it from two somewhat distinct disciplines here. On the one hand, imago is a term in Jungian psychoanalysis to refer to an internalized picture of an end stage of development, a kind of aspirational figure. We also use the term imago in its biological sense, where it is factually the end process of a biological process of growth. And so I'm not familiar with how imago functions in theology specifically.
If I say imago Dei, does that make it clearer?
Oh, okay. Yes. I got it. Okay. The sense in which we're using it is a little bit of a neologism to a certain extent. We're borrowing from these two different senses of the word imago. But as far as I know, there's not a history of people using this term in sociological studies. But it was a handy shorthand for us that describes both something that is descriptively the end process of the formation of the philosopher, as well as the, you know, maybe not consciously, but internalized ideal or picture of what that specific figure is in specific sociological terms. That's the imago question. If you have a follow-up or if Dave wants to add something, I'll pause so you can...
I just want to say before we move to the other part that, I mean, once the book explains the biological meaning of the term, I said, okay, that's a perfect term for it.
Wonderful. It's always nice to have a neologism that is a perfect term. I think when we came up with that one, I'm very fond of it myself. As for your second question, which has to do with where our book lands in terms of existing literature, so much has been written, of course, and rightfully so, about the economic, sociological thing that happened to the university in the last several decades, sometimes called the neoliberal turn. and the way in which higher ed has been transformed. We can talk about the sidelining of the humanities and the, you know, fetishism for science, and we can talk about a lot of the economic, you know, systematic impoverishment of the academic class via adjunctification. And a lot has been written on this, and that is certainly background for our work. Conversely, on the other side, a lot of ink has been spilled over what a philosopher is and what philosophy is. A lot. So where our book fits in is we are, you know, both of these are backgrounds. We are, however, specifically interested in the way that if we look at the specific material sociological determinations of philosophy as a profession, looking at it from the perspective that philosophers don't often adopt except as is convenient to them, which is looking at the empirical research, like what materially, extra-philosophically determines the life and social structures within the philosophical community. And for us, though, it's not necessarily in order to, you know, just simply say that's what philosophy is, so much as to say, well, here is what we do practically. This is how our lives and our institutional being is structured by these external material determinations. And we, you know, we sort of take as given that, you know, philosophy wants to change. Like, philosophy should become more inclusive, but that hasn't happened. So why is that? And so we look at the dynamic between what philosophers think about their own activity that makes it specifically as a field particularly reluctant to change, or has these ways that even as philosophy claims to be, you know, the torch of self-knowledge, right? Know thyself, that famous Delphic imperative. Well, philosophers who claim to know themselves actually have these beliefs about their own activity that prevents them from taking a sober look at the way it's determined by these external institutional factors. And so that specific dynamic is pretty crucial for our book, and it's borrowing from obviously a lot of research that's been done on the neoliberal turn, as well as, you know, what people have written. And there are other books that do address, that are sort of spiritually akin to our book. Brian Absher's The Rise of Neoliberal Philosophy is an excellent book that is very close to our ethical concerns and our overall diagnosis. But we, in our particular concern with the mythological role that philosophical, or the role that mythology plays in philosophical identity formation, I think that's fair, what we bring to the table, or what we bring to this conversation about the future of philosophy and the university more generally.
Good, good. Dylan, if I could follow up, when you two use the term imago, is it basically a synonym for ideal? And if not, how do those two terms relate to each other?
David, do you want to? I've been talking for a while. You want to take?
Well, you're doing better than me, so I think you should continue.
All right, that's totally fine. So the terms imago and ideal are very distinct, and we use the term ideal in a, much like imago, a sort of specialized way that we define for the book. Ideal is the mythological figure of the philosopher. So the philosopher as ideal is what philosophers think philosophers actually are. So one of the aspects of this, and we have a cute little thing where we spell idea and ideal with the L in parentheses. And when we use that term, we mean the
idea. I still remember the 90s, don't worry.
Oh, yes. We love our neologisms here, don't we, folks? So the ideal, when it comes to philosophy, is specific ideas of what a philosopher is. So we identify a few aspects of this figure. The first is that the philosopher is fundamentally solitary. The philosopher works by themselves. The philosopher is the one who withdraws from the world and sort of accesses truth directly via cognition, via thinking. You know, the armchair picture of the philosopher, which we, as philosophers, claim we've gone past, but we actually argue we haven't actually really gotten rid of that model of philosophical labor. Another aspect of the philosopher as ideal, i.e. what is properly philosophical activity, there's this notion that it has direct access to truth, and each philosopher is unique, has their own perspective, their own insight, right, that belongs to them properly. And another aspect is this notion that the philosopher exists in opposition to their community, and that we'd call this the philosopher as maverick, where the philosopher inherently is always persecuted for just, you know, knowing the truth, you know, canceled for truth is the philosopher, if you will. So all of these ideas that, again, philosophers might not necessarily quite avow, but nevertheless paint this picture of like what philosopher, like real philosophy is. And this is different from the imago, because the imago is the sociological, factical person who occupies the position of professional privilege, and as we said, is white, is male, whereas the idea of the philosopher is not necessarily that ostensibly, right? But has all of these things that make it properly, like philosophy proper. And we say that there's actually like a dynamic between these two that we outline in the book that we call the philosophical personality, which is there is a sense in which this notion that the philosopher being in opposition to the community, the philosopher thinking of his own activity as being radically solitary, as being against, you know, maverick, kind of a renegade, intellectual truth teller, you know, you think of this notion of parousia. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I just realized
That's how I say it, so we both say it wrong if we do.
Thank God, yeah, no, I've one of those moments where you're like, I've written this word a lot, but I haven't said it out loud a lot. But yeah, so how this philosopher as ideal actually prevents the philosophers from like recognizing the imago as actually occupying this privileged position. You know,
Very good.
Pass this over to me, David. I think I may have made a little bit of a hash of it. If you want to add anything, please let me know.
Well, if I could jump in here, I do want to unpack a couple of those points a little bit, and I want David to start off on one of them. And that is the notion of the philosopher as maverick, because I found this interesting because, I mean, I could tell you what my Shakespeare and Milton and Beowulf professors research and publish on, but I would have to look them up to tell you with whom they studied. On the other hand, my theology and biblical studies background, I know at least three of my own genealogies just reflexively. I tell people who don't even ask. I learned my theology from a disciple of George Lindbeck, and learned my Greek from a student of Bruce Metzger, and learned my history of biblical interpretation from a student of Bruce Steinmetz. And I could do more than that if, you know, I weren't boring the listeners already. But I've never set foot on either campus, but I can tell you that theologically, I'm a blend of Yale and Duke influences in the world. So, David, my question for you is, what about philosophy leads people to talk about the influence from more distant figures like Kant or Husserl, but they don't talk nearly as much about their dissertation directors?
Well, I think it's a question of the way in which philosophy creates a history for itself in terms of geniuses, in terms of these figures that become the building blocks of the canon. There's a lot of politics around canons in the humanities, of course. That's true of literature. I suspect it's also true of religious studies. And it's certainly true of philosophy, where we select these thinkers that we say have been influential in the history of philosophy and therefore merit inclusion in the list of the greats. Now, because of the way the cult of personality operates in philosophy, it leads those of us who are not members of the canon and never will be to try to establish philosophical legitimacy, sometimes by associations of descent, influence, and discipleship. Mm-hmm. So in the same way in which you can trace your genealogy, as you mentioned, to Yale and Duke influences, I can say, for example, and this would be a meaningful claim in philosophy circles, that I studied with somebody who studied under Gayatri Spivak, or that I studied under somebody who was the student directly of Jacques Derrida. Both of those claims are true in my case. And so, you know, there are these relationships of two, sometimes three degrees that are not only accidents, but that are thought to be revealing about the kind of philosopher that I am. And the reason that they're thought to be revealing is because of what Rebecca mentioned a minute ago, that in philosophy, we have the myth of the philosopher as the ground zero of a system of thought. So ideas, theories, systems of thought in philosophy have a proper name attached to them, right? There is Platonism. There is Heideggerianism, there is Kantianism. And if you can position yourself as the inheritor of one of these systems, it gives you a certain influence and a certain cachet in philosophy of an intellectual sort. It gives you a certain prestige. And I think that's why in philosophy, we often have the assumption that to be somebody means either to align yourself with an established way of thinking and therefore to carry the torch, as it were, or if you're a real radical thinker who wants to chart their own path, well, to put down the torch of another school of thought and invent a school of thought of your own, which of course is the highest compliment that you can pay a philosopher. And again, given the sorts of questions that we're asking in the book, our concern here is about how all of this has a mythic quality. It has this sense of not just telling us something that happens as a matter of fact in philosophy as a discipline, but it almost has a normative dimension where it tells us how we ought to be, how we ought to behave, what we ought to do if we want to be successful by the standards of the discipline. So much of our work is an attempt to understand all these myths that we tell ourselves about who we are as philosophers, even as we go about claiming that philosophy is the absence or the overcoming of myth.
Makes good sense. The other thing I want to unpack a little bit is this idea of persecution. So as we talk right now, I teach at a public high school and I serve a mainline Protestant congregation, but I spent a number of years and a fair bit of time in evangelical circles. So I've heard and read a lot about persecution stories in evangelical contexts. I haven't thought as much about persecution stories among philosophers, though I should have. I mean, once I think for a moment about Socrates and Seneca and Hypatia, I mean, we've got our persecution stories. So, Rebecca, talk to us about the ideal and the imago, now that I know that those are distinct terms. What social and institutional machinery shields imago philosophers from persecution, and what makes the rhetoric or the mythology of persecution, even from fellow professional philosophers, so persistent and so appealing for those in the profession?
Oh, I love this question. I was raised in an evangelical context, so I'm very familiar with exactly what you're referring to. And yes, indeed, I went from that to being in philosophy, where similarly, we tell these stories about these philosophers who were, you know, canceled or murdered for truth. You know, Socrates being the myth here, of course. And so to answer your first question, you know, one of the things we point out in the book is that the notion of being a maverick or being persecuted is really central to philosophical identity. And yet the people who occupy the position that are most quintessentially sociologically professor or philosophers are these, like, broadly white, male, tenured people. And as we outline in the book, it's very funny that, you know, people who do tend to end up with tenure have a tremendous amount of freedom of speech. The tenure, you know, not completely, and God knows tenure is going the way of the dodo for most of us, but when you are in that position...
Oh, don't I know.
You are shielded from the consequences of your speech. And, you know, that's a good thing. We're not looking to abolish tenure so that we can start, you know, firing people for having bad opinions or whatever. But more specifically, it's very funny that the people who are most psychically invested in this picture of being cast off from the community as suffering for truth, as being,
Parisiastes?
Yeah, something like that, yes.
Parisiastes.
People who are, you know, have courageous speech are the ones who are most insulated from its practical consequences. Talk about freedom of speech or suffering for truth if you are an adjunct or if you are in a position which most of us are in, where our employment is extremely tenuous, where the consequences for telling the truth will expel you from the realm of professional philosophy in this way. And so, you know, to answer the first part of your question, the people who occupy the position that is the most quintessential philosophy looking or seem to be the sociological picture of what a typical philosopher looks like are the people who are, in fact, most psychically invested in this myth that is simply not true for them. The second part of your question, which is what is it about being persecuted that is so appealing to people in the profession? I mean, I think that the answer to that question is pretty multifaceted, probably. How did we end up like this? Why did we end up selecting these pictures of these philosophers who are, you know, were harmed as a result of telling the truth to a public that could not or would not hear them? Well, we know there are as many philosophers who were basically court philosophers and who were very much not out of step with their community. Why do we choose the persecuted ones? I mean, I think in part it's just basically psychologically appealing to feel like you're in the, you know, the, one of the few people who really knows the truth, you know, one of the people who, you know, other people don't appreciate you, but you really get it. I think that's just on a very basic level psychologically appealing. But speaking more specifically to philosophers themselves, part of the picture of philosophy that has emerged for people is this notion that philosophy by itself is the pursuit of truth. And, you know, I David may have something to add, but I think that that's a very powerful idea that is extremely appealing, especially when you're not actually going to be meaningfully persecuted for saying something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe I'll add it here that we diagnose philosophers as suffering from a persecution complex. You know, we go around saying, hey, everybody's after us. You know, like, we're on the line, we're risking our lives for the sake of truth. And
that's so, you know, brave for you to say, David. That's so brave.
Yeah. Well, you know, I might be persecuted for this afterwards. But what's interesting to us is not to deny that there have been cases of persecution historically, of course, but why is this entire discipline so obsessed and so committed to this image of itself as persecuted? And one of the things that we do in the book that I'm very proud of us for being able to establish is that we show that this persecution complex really continues into the present, because we look at a number of surveys that have been conducted of professional philosophers and their beliefs. And that really feed this persecution complex. So a number of philosophers have carried out surveys of their peers, of thousands of professional philosophers, especially in the US, and asked them all kinds of questions, like, what do you think about ethics? What do you think about epistemology? What do you think about political theory? What are your beliefs about truth as correspondence versus as coherence, etc.? And so we looked at a lot of those answers, and the patterns that you notice in the beliefs that real living philosophers have today in the 21st century are very revealing. For example, most philosophers that have been interviewed in these surveys tend to misjudge how popular or unpopular their beliefs are. So for example, they'll say, this is my theory of truth. And across the board, they say, this is a minoritarian view, even when it is not. It is a majoritarian view. And so what we see is that there is this self-misunderstanding that's quite fundamental, where people really want to believe that they're going against the current, even when they are the current themselves. Similarly, many philosophers, a statistically significant number, will say things like, well, I work in moral theory. And moral theory, in the grand scheme of philosophy, is marginalized, even when the data suggests otherwise. And so this gap between what philosophers think about themselves and what's actually the case, based on empirical sociological research, is really fascinating to us, because it suggests a fundamental failure in self-knowledge. And much of our book tries to catch philosophers in these moments of self-ignorance. Because we believe that that's where you reveal the operating function of all these myths. And one of them is the myth of the philosopher as a suffering figure, as pure pathos.
Makes good sense. Listeners, I want to take a moment here and just say that these kinds of questions, you know, these relationships between what sociologists can observe and these myths that you know, motivate philosophers and, you know, create the worlds that philosophers occupy, it's massively complex. We're going to miss some of it, but there's a lot more in this book. You need to get your hands on it and have a read of it. But David, I want to jump to another part of the book, one where you talk about academic publication. And you talk about, you know, the fact that academic publication as the mark of professional achievement is a relatively new development. So talk to our listeners for a moment about what precedents we might be able to look to that came before Publish or Perish, and what kinds of possibilities are opening up or might open up if the Academy shakes its strong attachment to Publish or Perish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for listeners who are not professional philosophers or even professional academics, I think it's important to begin with the clarification that most academics split their lives between three pillars of academia. You have your research, your publications, you have your teaching, your pedagogy, and then you also have your service, which are your administrative duties, your contribution to the life of the university. And all of those things are equally important, of course, but depending on how you view who you should be as an academic, you will privilege one or another of these pillars more. In the case of philosophers, we argue, there is a fetishization of research specifically, right? The philosopher, to be a real philosopher, needs to be a publishing machine, somebody that is constantly churning out articles, constantly churning out books. Now, the reason for that is not just Publish or Perish, although that is a significant pressure in the last 30, 40 years. We actually make the claim that there is something intrinsic to philosophy, although it could exist in other disciplines as well, that makes philosophers believe that if they stop publishing, they will stop being philosophers. And the reason for that is because we have this myth in place that to be a philosopher means to have original thoughts that come from you and that nobody else has had. And that, of course, is the domain of research and publication. Now, we are not opposed to research and we're not opposed to publishing. Of course, you know, we published a book about this very subject that is now part of our research profile and it's in our CV. But there is something problematic about the disavowal of the other dimensions of our identity, especially teaching, because we think there is some truth in the notion that sometimes you hear among students that their professors are not really all that committed to teaching. This is not a universally true claim. It doesn't apply to everybody in the same way, but that there is something about the profession that draws people who can succeed in it even without considering themselves teachers. And that's very different than how philosophers have seen themselves historically. And so one of the possibilities for reinventing the myths of philosophy that we talk about in the concluding chapter of the book is about reclaiming our identity as teachers and as pedagogues. Because if you look at antiquity, for example, the essence of being a philosopher was teaching, right? You as a philosopher, you obviously wrote. Plato wrote dialogues. Aristotle wrote treatises. Seneca wrote letters. But the essential thing about being a philosopher really was influencing other people, shaping their lives, and helping them lead a good life. And there's a sense in which that is lost in a world in which the philosopher not only ceases to be a teacher and a mentor and an educator, but is reduced to a publishing machine. And so we are critical of the way in which neoliberalism, of which Publish or Perish is one expression, are morphing our identities as philosophers in ways that maybe we don't even realize. And so a lot of our work around the politics of publishing hinges on this insight, as well as on our understanding that the publishing industry in its contemporary form is fundamentally exploitative, because it takes academics who are under all kinds of pressure, and it takes the things that we produce in order to generate wealth and profit for large corporations, and we never see a dime, largely, of the wealth that is produced through our own research. In fact, What's even worse, we become consumers, like purchasers, of the very research that we as a community produce. And so think about how wild that is, that academics give their labor, their research for free to these private publishing conglomerates. They then make money out of it, and none of that money comes back to us. And so publishing then becomes a problem in our view for those two reasons. One is because it offers a very anemic understanding of what being a philosopher can mean. And secondarily, because it throws us into the middle of this whirlwind of economic exploitation at the hands of large-scale academic publishing.
And I got to follow up on that, because I tend to think about academic publishing as the territory of university presses, right? You know, I interview a lot of authors who write for Yale University Press, Baylor University Press, Princeton University Press. In your research, I mean, did you encounter any kind of numbers about what portion of academic publishing is actually done by university presses and what portion is done by these for-profit corporations?
Well, I mean, I'll answer this in part. We didn't study specifically the distinction between for-profit and university presses, for example. But the most common sort of academic writing that is produced and is consumed is done via journal articles rather than books, although we do talk about books as well. The journal articles, even when they are produced, say, by a not-for-profit journal, are aggregated and then resold to universities through EBSCO, through JSTOR, that extract massive amounts of money by distributing it. And this includes actually academic books as well. So for example, if I publish something for, you know, with OUP, then OUP is going to sell the distribution rights to Springer or to Project Muse or to any number of these for-profit distributors. So I take your point about not-for-profit publishing, but I think the issue, even if we broaden the scope to include articles, is pretty obvious, and it's still very much a for-profit publication system in aggregate. In fact, a lot of the idea of scholarly community publications, those have been in decline for a while, and right now the biggest moneymaker really is locking, you know, your article on the exploitation of academic labor behind $32 to view, you know, or you can rent it for the low, low price of $15 for 2 days, etc.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like I said, I mean, this is a side of academic publishing I really hadn't given much thought to. So, I mean, your book's very helpful for me in that respect. Well, Rebecca, another economic problem, and I think of it as an economic problem. If I need to think about it otherwise, you can correct me, of course, that you deal with in the book is overwork. And, you know, it's interesting that overwork is such a problem among people whose professional lives don't directly involve sales benchmarks or productivity quotas. You write about overwork as a point of honor among academics particularly. So do you think that emerges from a generation of fighting for the place of the humanities, you know, against the science fetishism that you talked about earlier? Do you think it's from a sort of latent Weber-flavored Protestant work ethic? What's going on here? I know I'm asking you all to explain all these things that your book just observes. That's what I do. I get curious. I ask follow-up questions. What's going on here, Rebecca?
Oh, well, what's going on here? I don't think this is limited to the humanities. There may be inflections that are a result of the much more brutal job market, the systematic devaluation of this kind of work that could perhaps inflect one's experience of this overwork fetish, for sure. But I think it's something that is true, I think, across almost all white-collared salary professions to a degree. This notion that you identify with your work is a marker of economic and personal value. I think this is a broader cultural thing that is not unique per se to academia, but I do think in academia it adopts a greater degree, if not quality. So in academia, there's this notion that you're doing what you love. Right. You are passionate about theology. You're passionate about science. You pursue it. It's the life of the mind. It's you get to do what you love every day. And when you combine this with the publisher parish, and, you know, if you want to take it to the humanities as a context specifically, the intense competitiveness for jobs, there's this idea that you should, to be a real scholar, to be a real philosopher, to again be even more specific, you are living the life of the mind. This is your vocation, and this is where Weber comes in. This notion that our work as academics, and this is also true of teaching, is a calling. It's not just a job where you clock in and you hand people what they need and then you clock out and you go on with your life. No,
and that is especially powerful at Christian colleges. I'll go ahead and add there.
Vocation, very much so, right? The vocation of pastoring. But the fact is, fundamentally, we are workers. And when I go and I teach a class or I do research, what I am doing is I'm doing labor. And the conflation of this obscures the power relations that underlie this properly economic question. Because if I don't perceive it as work, it bleeds into all aspects of my life. It becomes my identity. And try organizing for better working conditions when people don't think what they do is actually work, right? So I don't, you know, to answer your question, I don't think it's specific to the humanities. I do think it is intensified in academia, though not unique. And I think that it really prevents us from seeing ourselves as workers, and it makes us party to self-exploitation, even when we're in relatively cushy jobs, actually. And I'm sure, you know, as a teacher, you're very familiar with the way that this kind of work bleeds into your own personal time.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, David, I'm going to step on the gas here in the home stretch because there's so much more I want to talk about, but I am going to try to limit us to an hour. The book's fourth chapter focuses on adjuncts as part of the academic humanities ecosystem. And I have to confess at this turn that I'm part of the problem. Since leaving academia to teach high school, I've taken on some adjunct courses, partly because I want to revisit my glory days as an English professor, and partly because I've had a run of bad luck lately and need to pay for some home repairs. So I confess at the outset, I am driving down the price of academic labor. The most interesting part of your adjunct chapter for me was your claim that adjuncts have certain epistemic advantages over the imago philosophers. So talk to our listeners for a moment. What do adjuncts know that tenure-track professors don't know?
Well, to give the shortest possible answer is that they know the system is messed up and they can see it because they live it in the flesh, more so than somebody like me who is in a tenured position in one of those protected spaces in the universe of academia, because those of us in those positions are protected from seeing the realities of the adjunct experience by basically every aspect of our daily existence. And so if you think about academia as a place where there are these two communities of workers, you have tenured or tenure track professors who are given endless privileges. We have our own private office. I'm recording this interview from the comfort of my private office on campus. We are given research funds. We are given access to grants that we can apply for professional development or for pedagogical innovation. We have the protections literally of tenure. I know that I will not be fired or discontinued unless there's a major financial crisis, which, you know, is becoming more and more likely as well, but still doesn't equalize things. And so On our reading, the adjunctification of academia has produced a whole class of workers without any of these protections. The day-to-day life of an adjunct is very different. Without space to work on campus, without the guarantees of job security, without health insurance, in many cases, even without the possibility of like using computers on campus or applying for things that other people can apply to. And so the difference in lived experience produces an asymmetry in epistemic access, where everything about my career, at least recently, because I've been in non-tenure track positions before, is designed really to conceal from me the many ways in which exploitation is all around me and in which even I, as a tenured professor, participate in it because I have colleagues in my department who are not tenured and over whom I do exercise, just by the nature of the beast, some really weird forms of power. And I think it's important here to underscore that this is not a problem of personal choices or individual responsibility. So, you know, you begin by saying, I'm driving down the prices of academic labor. And obviously you're half
kidding. It's a Christian podcast, David. I'm confessing my sins.
Yeah. There is a confessional element here. And I want to say that you're not the problem. You are part of the problem insofar as like you expose the problem, right? Like your job position, your economic circumstance highlights something about modern academia that shouldn't exist. Now, to connect this to the theme of mythology and professional philosophy, we make the argument in the book that very obviously, and there's a lot of sociological research that shows this, adjuncts are economically and politically excluded from the life of the university. They are not allowed roles in university governance. They are not allowed basic forms of representation in departmental dynamics. And of course, the remuneration is beyond the pale. Aside from that economic and political exclusion, there's a kind of mythic exclusion that we introduce in the book, where we say, given the things that professional philosophers value, because we have all these myths and all these fantasies about what a real philosopher looks like, the adjunct can never meet that. The adjunct can never be a real philosopher in the eyes of a philosopher who is tenured. And the reason for that has to do with some of the things that we've already talked about. Philosophers fetishize research. Adjuncts don't have time for research because they're moonlighting across multiple institutions trying to make ends meet. Philosophers associate being a philosopher with having your own ideas rather than just teaching. Well, the majority of adjuncts spent most of their time teaching in the classroom, doing work that we used to valorize in philosophy, but no longer do in the same way. And so aside from the political, social, and economic exclusion of adjuncts, we also have to talk about the fact that they're denied an identity that many of them want and many of them should be granted just as a matter of course. But given the mythic dynamics of the profession, it's simply not happening.
That's good. Rebecca, I want to run with something that you said earlier, that we need new myths. And of course, this is something that, you know, the first parts of the book, really the first three quarters of the book, set up. And one of the myths that, you know, strikes me as especially promising, and David touched on it just now, has to do with reconceiving the sage not as the maverick who stands against the crowd, but as the carrier and preserver of certain good traditions. Now, my own conservative streak is well known to our listeners, so I don't discount the possibility that the appeal begins there. You use one of those McIntyre words and my ears perked up. That's entirely possible. But for you, what about tradition as a mythic element strikes you as promising?
Yeah. So thank you for your question. So when we think about tradition, we don't value tradition for its own sake because it's traditional, right? We are, in this sense, perhaps not conservative. But rather, when we turn to the existing landscape of stories and ideas that exist already in what is considered to be the ground of philosophy or the canon, and we can debate what that looks like, we don't think that you can just sort of wake up one day and, as if you had no roots, just out of nowhere, come up with a myth that will solve philosophy's problems, because we are, in some sense, materialists. We think that we, you know, there is a ground, there is a place from which we come, and there are things that have existing resonances and existing valuations and meanings for people. So, you know, when we talk about going back to the tradition, and we can, again, tradition maybe in scare quotes, it's not because it's traditional, or it's not this idea of, like, you know, carrying forth this ancient flame that has been burning in secret and we now will reveal to the light. Rather, it's by acknowledging that we sort of exist within a given of sorts. But what we do with that, right, should be open for contestation and revisitation. So when we talk about the sage, right, we're interested in the way that this is a figure that has meaning, right, in a given community that can be interpreted otherwise. So rather than being this maverick that's, you know, to use another biblical term, kicking against the pricks, you know, who's, you know, existing with this direct relationship to truth, we can highlight, right, aspects of it that are communal, that are, have to do, right, with almost a caretaking sort of role, with this not notion of, like, transferring tradition just to remain traditional so much as, like, being able to reconceptualize what it means to be a philosopher in a way that's embedded in a community, that's tied to teaching, that's not just this notion of I exist independently. And in fact, one of the myths we want to revisit is that of the maverick. We don't want to throw that out, right? We want philosophers to have this oppositional relationship to the given order, but our claim is that this myth, in order to be remythologized, it should be earned and not given by virtue of, you know, having a tenured professional philosophical role. Rather, we want it to be an aspirational aspect of philosophical identity rather than one that one gets because one's, you know, a little bit contrarian in faculty.
David, there are some authors who are thrilled to get asked questions about the appendix and some who say, who is this guy? So you can decide which response you're going to take here. But one of the figures you treat in the appendix is Pierre Hadot, and he is a figure who has greatly influenced me, especially when I taught, you know, philosophy courses as a professor. So I was surprised that you seem to dismiss him somewhat as lacking resources for addressing institutional realities and as especially easily co-opted by capitalism. So since this is your interview and not mine, talk to our listeners a little bit. What features of Hadot's project lead you to those critiques?
David, I want you to take this one because you're the Hadot guy.
Well, we talk about this in passing in the appendix because a number of other people who also work on questions of metaphilosophy, the sociology of the discipline, have turned to Hadot to try to envision a new way forward in changing the nature of the discipline. And Hadot's project in general has a lot to do with going back to the ancients and reclaiming the value of living well or the good life. And so if we were to just summarize it in a few words, Hadot, a French historian and philosopher, thought that in the modern period, philosophy really started obsessing about questions of knowledge and in so doing, abandoned questions of the good life. How do I lead a good life? And there have been scholars who have turned to Hadot to try to suggest that this is something philosophy can learn from as a way of reinventing itself or revamping itself. Now, our own take about this is that there is a kind of individualism sort of built into the Hadotian perspective, where the goal largely is living a good life as an individual or on an individual basis. And of course, you know, I suspect there are alternative ways of reading Hadot, which is why we don't engage him directly in the book. You know, with all critiques of philosophers, there are always rebuttals and possible answers. But this is a way for us to...
And I'll spare you mine today, David.
Oh, no worries. But this is really a way of saying something about our position rather than Hadot's. And that is that our position is that change in philosophy will not come when individual philosophers learn to lead a good individual life. Because philosophy is an institution, it's a social form, and it's nested within a large beast that is the neoliberal university. And so one of the problems with failing to take into consideration that institutional perspective is that it really prevents large-scale social change, and it prevents us from targeting those widespread myths that shape how we see ourselves as members of those institutions. And so that's where our focus goes as materialists, as Rebecca said, who are interested in thinking about myths, not just as ideas that people have about the world, but as material practices that have certain effects when they move through a social field. And so that's where our relationship to Hado comes in. I would say it's highly qualified. And it's really not about Hado as much as people's attempt to use a Hadoian perspective to push for a particular future for philosophy in the present.
All right, David, you pacified me. But Rebecca, I want to pose one more question, and again from the appendix. I'm that guy. What can I say? But this struck me as an especially promising way to close our talk today. You write about demythologizing and remythologizing, not as tasks that we take care of on Monday, and then we don't have to worry about it on Tuesday. They are ongoing work. So offer our listeners some sage counsel here. What concrete practices might lead to the best kinds of demythologizing and remythologizing in the next few academic years?
Well, you know, the wonderful thing about saying in an appendix that it's an ongoing work and not something you can accomplish overnight is that I could recuse myself from giving anyone specific pieces of advice. I think on some level, you know, this is a question that we are always wrestling with, because on one level, I as an individual, what can I do, is always going to be a question somebody's going to want to ask. And the answer is, I'm not sure. Let me add, though, that I think one of the things that we can suggest is something like, you know, dependent upon your material position within philosophy. If any of your listeners are tenured philosophy people, I mean, take a hard look in the mirror and recognize, right, that you, not in the sense of flagellate yourself and feel guilty. That doesn't accomplish much of anything. And in fact, we tend to fetishize guilt a little bit. You know, mea culpa, maxima culpa. But to recognize the actual material facticity that underlies your position, to recognize the operations of power where you see it, to understand and acknowledge and support your non-tenured colleagues in material ways, not just posting like, ah, yes, solidarity, but actually standing in solidarity with your untenured comrades. And another thing is to broaden your perspective about what counts as philosophy. One of the things that runs through the book is this disciplinary exclusion that not just excludes people who are people of color or women who have done what we might identify as like very specifically philosophical work, but broadening our understanding of what philosophy is and can do. So not being territorial about our discipline, if you are within philosophy, would be one good step. And I don't know if most of your listeners are academics or if they are where they lie in terms of the academy, but my advice would be different depending on where they are. And this isn't going to, an individual change isn't going to be accomplished overnight. It's not something that any one of us can do individually, but being in community with others is always going to have to be the starting point, which is something philosophers are almost constitutively incapable of doing.
Indeed, indeed. Well, David, I have been at the wheel for most of today's conversation. So in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you and Rebecca have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about myths, academic culture, philosophy, or whatever else as we head for the door? Speak your word, David, and then pass the baton to Rebecca, and then we will wrap things up.
Yeah, so I would want to underscore that even though Rebecca and I are certainly giving off the impression of being persona non grata in the discipline, because we are hypercritical of the profession, we are indeed critical of the formation that we have received, of the formation that we are expected to give our students, of the social dynamics that just permeate the discipline, of the expectations that we fashion ourselves in a particular way in order to gain social recognition. So even though we are critical of that, our book really grows out of a deep love that we have for philosophy and out of a desire to see philosophy open itself up, not just to new people and to new spaces, but to new versions of what it can be. And so this is very much a labor of love project that we embarked on when we were graduate students. And I'll say that even in our current positions, Rebecca and I have always been with one foot in and one foot out in philosophy in one way or another. For example, Rebecca has been part of the community of adjuncts for years. So she has felt that political, economic, and mythic exclusion in the flesh. I myself went on the job market and I succeeded at landing a tenured position, but not in a philosophy department. And so I've had to continue my academic work also from a distance with one foot in, one foot out. And so we are writing this book from the margins of philosophy in different ways. And I think that marginal position is something that we already felt when we were graduate students by virtue of both of us being having a low economic class background, where there is a certain elitism in professional academic spaces that we didn't know how to navigate. So whether it's in terms of gender, in the case of Rebecca, whether it's in the case of race for me, whether it's in the case of socioeconomic background for both of us, or whether it's institutional affiliation and job standing, again, in the case of both of us, but differently, we've felt the force of these exclusions. And so we wrote this book as a way of encouraging philosophers to be open to new ways of being philosophers and to be open to other people entering the field or being recognized in the field when they're already in it. So that's what I would want to simply say, that this book really is about creating a better future for philosophy, which is why in the dedication part of the book, we dedicate this book to future philosophers. Maybe the changes that we want to see in philosophy won't come overnight. They won't be here by Monday. They won't be here by 2030 or 2040. But we hope that the next generation of philosophers will be given a new landscape and a new mythic space in which they might be able to move otherwise.
Rebecca?
And so,
you're good. I think that was beautifully put, David. And I think anything I would add would perhaps take away from that powerful final statement. But one thing I will also add on a more practical level is one of the myths we take aim at, which is not unique to philosophy, is this notion of meritocracy. And so whether you're in a position where you've been successful, or you're maybe washed out of academia, as more and more of us are washing out of academia, whether by choice or by circumstances, you know, disabusing yourself of this notion that your job reflects who you are, or that your success reflects merit, I think can be very powerful on an individual psychological basis. And, you know, getting rid of those mental shackles in which so many of us live, where if only I'd published more, if only my evals were better, if only I went to more conferences, you know, if you can, obviously that's material security, that's professional prestige, that's the reality. But if you can free your mind from being ego invested in those things as much as possible, that is tremendously freeing, I will say, having somewhat given up on that notion myself.
Morgan, Rebecca, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you so much. This has been really great. You asked some wonderful questions, and it's been a delight talking to you.
Yes, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Professional Philosophy and Its Myths from Lexington Books. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.